New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos. You can now download a free PDF copy or purchase a beautiful printed edition of Issue 5 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jeffrey Mishlove. Today we'll be exploring the concept of the defining moment, the turning point in our lives. My guest is Dr. Davis Brimberg. She is a clinical psychologist, a former college professor, and a former handler of wild owls. She is the author of Teachings from the Gatekeeper, a memoir and journey into parapsychology. Welcome, Davis.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me here today. I'm very, very excited to be here.
Thank you for making the journey to Albuquerque.
Yes, it's my pleasure.
All the way from Seattle.
Yes.
I'm delighted to have you here in my little studio. And I know that you used to live in New Mexico.
Yes, I lived in Santa Fe. I lived in Santa Fe for a few years. It was wonderful. I loved it.
We will be talking, not in this interview so much, but in a subsequent interview about your work in Santa Fe, which involved working with wild animals.
Yes.
Today, though, we're going to focus on the concept of the defining moment, which is a very important concept in your book. It's how you introduce the book by talking about what was a defining moment in your life. And I guess maybe to set the stage, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you began your adult career really as a very insecure person.
Well, I had a lot of trouble academically. It was not just academics. I had all sorts of troubles in many different areas. I failed in so many different areas, but there was a lot of academic failure. Well, what happened was also it became time to go to college. And I told my parents that I was not going to go to college.
And coming from a Jewish family, that is tough.
This is like not going to happen. Yeah. And they said, yeah, good luck. Pick a school. And so I said, I made a plea bargain with them. I said, the only way I'm going to go is if I can be a dance major. And they said, fine. So the best dance programs in the country required SAT scores along with grades and dance auditions. My SATs were terrible. My grades were terrible. And anyway, so I applied as a dance major. And on the day of one of my auditions, the New York area was hit with a surprise blizzard. People talk about defining moments as being, they often connect to things like births and marriages and big job promotions and things of that nature. And those things are major life events. But to me, the defining moment happens when somebody goes through something very difficult, when they go through some sort of adversity, or the person is stuck in some difficult situation that they have to navigate. And very often, when you look at stories of defining moments, they typically involve rebellions. So they are acts of defiance, where a person comes to defy someone or something. And in my book, I talk about famous examples of defining moments, people who have defied societies, defied cultural norms. Mine was far more personal.
In my story, many viewers know, I went through a transition from being a criminology major to creating a unique doctoral degree in parapsychology. It was a turning point for me, and that has defined my life ever since.
Yes. Well, for me, the defining moment is a very rare event. I've only had one, and it sounds like, am I right, that you've had one, as you would say?
Of that magnitude, yes.
Of that magnitude. And so for me, I had to get into college. I very stupidly only applied to four schools, and one of them I knew for certain was going to reject me. I mean, it was like a throwaway audition. So I really only had three shots. And on the day of my audition, the New York area was hit with a surprise blizzard. My mother was supposed to drive me in to New York City. We lived 1 hour away from the audition. And she said, look, they closed the highways, they closed the major roads, they closed the airports that day. I mean, there was just the whole place shut down. But she said, look, you can get in by the subways and the train. But at that point in my life, my parents had forbidden me to take a train anywhere. And they had forbidden me to walk in New York City anywhere. But my mother made an exception. She saw how unglued I became. Then we had this big argument, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so I get in there. I have to go through the trains and the subways and walk the series of blocks to my audition. Of course, it's, the blizzard out. It's just dumping snow and wind everywhere. And finally, I get to my audition, and I am the only one who has showed up. It is this massive, cavernous space of a studio, because the evaluators expected to have a ton of girls, a couple of boys, but it's really girls. There's nobody there. The only people who are there are me and the three evaluators. Normally, what happens is that everybody is assigned a number, and you are lined up at the bar according to your number. And then they break you down into groups, and then they break you down into pairs, and then they say, with the following numbers, please leave. I'm sorry, we're not interested. And then 85 to 90% of the room leaves, and then the remaining dancers do their solo. And then you're interviewed by one person. So now on this day, I'm now interviewed by three of them, right, at once. Why do you want to go here? Why do you want to go to the school? Then, there's no point in lining me up at the bar. You can't put me in a pair. You can't put me in a group. So they go and they give me what is the hardest part, which is, I'm not a gymnast. I can't even do a cartwheel. But if I was, you'd call it the long program. It's this long section of choreography, which I then have to do. And, they teach it to you, and within 2 minutes, you have to perform a band. It's not like go in the hall, practice it for a little bit. It's not go at home, practice it for 2 weeks. It's here's the choreography. You got 2 minutes. Boom, boom, boom. Let's go. And by the way, this is how you're going to get into college or not. And it was just one thing after another. And finally, a second dancer showed up. And I was like, thank God. Thank God you're here. And she danced with me for the rest of the audition, and that was it. There were no other dancers that showed up. But I left the audition, and it wasn't even for my dream school. My dream school was the next week. And I got through that audition, and I was like, oh, thank God, bring it on. The next one is the dream school. But what happened was that I developed an awareness that my miserable sense of self that had been accumulated from all of the years of failure, academic, all of the other failures from everything else, that miserable sense of self no longer made sense anymore. What happened was that the day was so arduous. I had to get through my mom. I had to get through all of the different subways. I had to get to the audition on time. It was essential for me that I get there on time. Then I was interviewed by three of them. Then we go through the whole thing. It was just one task after another. And so what happened is that this sense of self that I had, that I was a complete failure, was obliterated. And what occurred was this awareness that I was somebody who was capable of succeeding. And it was the first time in my life that I had seen this, so much to the point where my miserable sense of self, that awareness of it, it was as if I died. It was a metaphorical death. And then this awareness that success for me was possible was in a birth. And over the years, I always knew the day was so important to me. But it wasn't until several years ago where I did my Myers-Briggs. And the Myers-Briggs test showed my profile.
The personality test.
Yes. Yes. And for those people who may not know, the Myers-Briggs is a test that was developed by, it's based on the theories of Jung on his psychological types. And it's a non-pathological type. It's just an examination of personality. And my profile, which is an ENTJ, I looked at it and I went, oh my God, every part of my personality, good, bad, and indifferent, was on display that day. Every part of it. And I realized that there was no other event in my life where that was the case, where one day showed everything. An ENTJ stands for extroverted, intuitive, thinking, and judgment. And all of those pieces were there, driven. If there was life in my body, I was getting there. I was going to show up on time, and I was going to get that job done. There was no plan B. It didn't exist. This was my only chance of getting into college. Competitive? I was like, fuck this blizzard. Snow, the wind, it's competitive with the weather. I got competitive with the weather. Planning is another part of the ENTJ. I remember where I stood in my home. I remember thinking, all right, your mom just said the trains could be delayed. The trains could also be perfectly on time. You could get lost. You've never been to Grand Central Station alone. The place is chaos. You've never been through these subways alone. You could get out on the wrong block, walk 12 blocks in the blizzard, and then have to go back in the blizzard just to retrace your steps. You don't know where you're going. So I came up with the idea that if I had 3 hours, if I could pad the day by 3 hours, that I had a chance of having a train being delayed and getting lost and figuring it out and getting there on time. I mean, these were just like all the ENTJ aspects. And there's more of them, but there's a lot for us to talk about. But then I thought about all the psychic experiences that I've had. And I've had a ton of them, not at the level of a professional psychic, but certainly more than the average person. I've had a couple of hundred psi episodes in my life.
Even before that experience?
Oh, I've had all sorts of psi episodes as a child and as a teenager. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then when I thought about the psi episodes, the most dominant part of my psi ability is claircognizance, which hits perfectly with the ENTJ because it hits with the T part. The ENTJ is, you know, planning, organized. These are not spontaneous people. It's not
so
at
the
all.
The T is thinking, isn't it?
The T is the thinking part of it.
Yeah.
And I looked at this and I went, oh my God, all of these pieces hang together. And they were all there on that particular day.
Well, what struck me in your story is you describe it as a death and a rebirth.
Yes.
Would be the classic definition of an initiation.
It was, you know, I'm probably the only person in the history of your show for 30 some odd years to ever talk about a dance audition.
That is correct.
It's so ridiculous.
Uh-huh.
It's so ridiculous.
You went into dance because you didn't think you could succeed in any other field.
I wasn't succeeding in any other field. I mean, it was, forget my perception, that was reality. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was, the amount of failure that I experienced was just, it was grim.
Yeah.
And ultimately, you know, in terms of the story of what happened, I did go to my dream dance department at NYU, and I did leave because it was clear I wasn't going to become a dancer. And I blossomed academically, and I became a straight A student, graduated with honors, went out to graduate school as a master's and a PhD student and was a straight A student and honors and all of that. So it was there, the way in which I saw myself, it just didn't apply anymore. And it, in when I saw these things on that day, the evidence was so big, I couldn't deny it. There was just way too much evidence that was mounted out, all of it, the idea that I was permanently doomed to fail just didn't make sense. And so there was this feeling of this death and rebirth. The other thing too, and an awareness of it, is in writing this book, you know, if you do a memoir, you have to look at yourself, right? You have to look at all of the pieces. For better or worse, you need to really fully examine what happened here. And when I wrote the book, I realized that I had never told that story from beginning to end to anybody. The only time that I told that story in its entirety was when I wrote the book. I had told people pieces of that story. And I reflected on that more because, you know, as a psychologist, I'm not particularly compartmentalized. Somebody tells me something and I'm like, oh yeah, that reminds me of a dream that we spoke about a month ago. It reminds me of this thing you mentioned that happened with your mom when you were a child, or the thing that you talked about a year ago. And I'm connecting dots, right? And I'm connecting dots because I'm free associating and because I'm not compartmentalized. And then I looked at what was going on with this and I was like, well, you sure are compartmentalized in your personal life because this thing got put into a box. And when I look at why that happened, it's the metaphorical death. It's not only all the miserable shit that went into creating the miserable sense of self, but it's the idea that I died metaphorically that day. And the metaphorical death of a child is an inherently sad thing. And I think these are the pieces as to why it was so compartmentalized.
It seems to me you really needed to break out of your childhood. You were protected. Oh. You couldn't ride on the subway by yourself. Oh. You know, I spent some teenage years in New Jersey. And as a teenager, even long before college, I would take the bus and go into Manhattan by myself, and my sisters would do as much. But I get the idea that your parents were really overprotective not to allow you to do that.
Well, part of it was I was a girl, of course. Mm-hmm. So maybe if I was a boy, maybe they would have given me a little bit more leeway. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, you would only be referred to as Dr. Mishlam. I could not refer to you as Jeff with my parents.
I see.
Or with anybody. You know, I had to be at least 18 years old in order to call you Jeff.
Well, I think there's more to the story because we're talking about a poor student with low self-esteem. And usually that's the sort of thing that's passed on to young children by their parents who got it from their parents.
Well, what happened was... my parents, I mean, they loved me dearly, and I loved them dearly, but they panicked when they saw me develop, they got very anxious, and they just sort of panicked and really projected all sorts of anxieties onto me. And me being the little empath that I am, I just sort of sucked up all their projections as a child, as so many open and empathic children do. And what happened was on this day, it was a rebellion against my sense of self, but it was also a rebellion against my parents. And we both had miserable expectations of me. I had bad expectations of me, although I did apply to the strongest dance departments in the country. So there was some sense of me, right, that felt success was possible, or else I wouldn't have done that.
I can picture you as a dancer.
But my parents, though, you know, it was a rebellion against them. Mm-hmm. And they absolutely, unequivocally needed to be defied by me in this way. It was the best thing that could have happened to our relationship. It was the best thing that could have happened to my relationship with myself. And it was the best thing that could have happened for my relationship with them.
And I gather after that event, maybe starting when you were at NYU in the dance school, you began to realize that you had other talents. People came to you for guidance.
Yes. It was interesting is that, you know, the first several days of NYU, it was brutal. They basically put us into what they called placement classes. And all the freshmen and the sophomores were mixed together, and then you were placed into different groups, depending on how well or how poorly you performed. They basically re-auditioned us against each other on a daily basis. It was just god-awful. And I remember thinking, if I could just get to, like, you know, out of week two, I'll be fine. You know, maybe they might allow me to stay. I mean, the amount of talent I was surrounded by was just staggering. It was also disturbing, you know. But the girls that I danced with, they were wonderful, but, you know, they were also freaked out. I mean, it was a terrifying experience. Everybody has some kind of sense of self, even when they're 17, as to how they are. And all of us had auditioned to get in there. All of us came from some sort of strong background. And now you got to see, like, wow, you see this chick? She just did blah, blah, blah. It's, like, ridiculous. But in what happened was that during the first couple of weeks of school, I had three of my freshman dance mates come to see me in my dorm. And they came there and they just started talking to me about the things that were bothering them. And I never told anybody that they came to see me. They came in, they poured their hearts out, they left. And they barely knew me, which is the part that really represents and really kind of starts to simulate a psychotherapy session, right? It was not kids who I hung out with at camp who got to know me and then felt comfortable and then a month in, right? These are people who knew me for like 10 days. And there they were. The other interesting thing around this time is that I got into psychotherapy and I worked on myself. And just as I was in the program as a dancer, I also saw I was never going to have a career in dance, right? It was just...
You were good, but not great.
It was not happening. Mm-hmm. It was sort of like being on a Division I team and never seeing 1 minute of the NFL. Mm. It was sort of like that. And at the time that I was in psychotherapy and working on myself in the dance department, I also started to do well academically, really well. And I started to see at this point that there were many things that I could do, that I wasn't just going to become a dancer or struggle to become a dancer, but that there was much more to me. And I didn't know that until this day, frankly. I mean, it really goes back to this particular day in this studio.
Battling through the snowstorm.
I mean, it was just crazy. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing was just, it was a crazy experience. It was the hardest experience of my life. And I don't just mean the audition. I mean the entire day, all of the management involved in that day, mm-hmm. the getting through all of the subways, the having to manage that, the Grand Central, my mom, the being the only dancer, being interviewed by three of them. It was just, all of it was so difficult and so stressful. And the pressing need to be on time. I had to be on time. In my mind, if I was late, I would have failed. I would have destroyed the whole thing. And it was the hardest experience of my life. And it was the best thing that's ever happened to me. Mm-hmm. Because after going through all of those difficult things, I got to see I got to see who I am. And you know, it's a weird thing to say. It's a weird way of phrasing this, but it's as if I met myself for the first time that day.
Well, that's a wonderful thing to do.
I was like, oh, thank God. Here you are. Yeah. Hello.
Subsequently, I gather, as you evolved, of course, became a psychologist, but you also began to develop a deeper understanding of the psychic experiences that you had had since childhood.
Yes.
And you began to renew your relationship with your parents.
Oh, yeah. My parents, they really loved me. They also projected a lot of anxiety onto me, as many Jewish parents do.
All parents.
All parents,
it's,
too.
It's
yes.
not unique to Jewish parents, but I think it's certainly a feature of Jewish life is anxiety, of course.
Yes, absolutely. And they loved me dearly, projected a ton onto me, and then they really saw me in a different way. They really did get that. And it was a beautiful thing that was able to happen in our lifetime together. But, it was a difficult beginning, that is for sure. And yet, my parents were very, very supportive of me.
I gather that there are ways in which, and I'm sure this happens in all families, but it's not always so obvious as it seems to have occurred for you, a kind of psychic entanglement.
Yes.
With the, between parents and children.
Well, my parents did not believe in anything spiritual whatsoever. They certainly had no interest in religion. Although they identified very much as culturally Jewish, if you really dug into their beliefs, they were atheists. But my parents, they didn't believe in anything spiritual. They believed that when we die, that's it. Our physical body dies. And one person, when I was a child, told my father that she could read auras. He thought that was the funniest thing he'd ever heard. And I remember thinking, well, that sounds kind of cool. Maybe she could read auras. What's an aura? You know, I was, 10. Ooh. But they didn't believe in any of this. My mother, though, several months after my father died, she said to me, something weird happened. I said, really? What's that? She said, I was in the bathroom one day, and it's like your father was with me. And it scared me so much. It petrified me, scared me to death. And she said, and then a couple of weeks later, it happened again. And she said, I was driving. And it scared me, but it didn't scare me as much. And then I spoke with him. We had a whole conversation. And I said, well, what did you talk about? And she said, I'm not telling you that. I said, wait a second. You said you don't believe in any of this, and now you want to uphold the confidentiality between you and my deceased father's spirit? And she said, yeah, that's right. So, well, it's a good thing you don't believe in this. And then there's this long pause on the phone, this long pause. And she goes, you may be onto something. So my mother was able to soften on that. You know, she had that direct experience. For so many people, they need a direct experience. Once they get that, then they start opening up to these things.
That's even true for parapsychologists.
Yes.
You can look at all the data. You can run experiments. But until you've had an experience of your own, there's always this element of doubt.
Yes. So, but as a child, though, I naturally had all sorts of parapsychological experiences, whether they were pre-cognitive dreams, which is, I go into one of them into my book, or clear cognizance. You know, I had this miserable sense of self, but I also had this awareness that my life trajectory was going to change. And I didn't know how it was going to change exactly, but I always knew that it would happen. And I didn't foresee the blizzard, but I knew that it would occur. And, you know, progress is not such a linear thing. It's zigzag, it's asymmetrical. It's not like my, you know, the blizzard happened and boom, you know, my life was complete. There were many aspects of my life that desperately needed work, and happened. But in terms of the area of achievement, that was, put much more into motion on that particular day.
Now, you use the term claircognizance. Can you define that? It's not a normal term that I run into in parapsychological circles.
It's a clear knowing. Mm-hmm. It's a variation of psi and psi mm-hmm. abilities, like clairvoyance or clairsentience, mm-hmm. things along those lines.
Claircognizance. I like that term.
Well, it's precognition.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Well, precognition is seeing the future. Cognizance, as you described it earlier, implies thinking.
Yes. Or knowing.
Yes. Like an intuition.
Yes. But it's an intuition that it's unshakable. Mm. It would be like, it's a knowing that something is going to happen.
A certainty.
Yes. And it's a certainty that you cannot knock out.
Yeah.
It's and I had that as a child. Uh-huh. And, you know, and people have asked me, well, maybe it was faith. Maybe you had some sort of faith that your life would change. Faith to me implies that it's external. Mm. And this was not external. This was, a clear knowing.
Clearly, inside this insecure, frightened, protected, sheltered little girl, there was the person who you now are waiting to come out.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. That is true.
And I gather over time, your relationship with your father also softened.
Yes. My father was my favorite person. And this was true even when I was a child, even when I was, you know, failing miserably and our relationship had its struggles. He was always my favorite person. And I talk about him in the book in different pieces. There's a precognitive dream that I have that concerns his death. Mm-hmm. And then he appears again, in another dream of mine that is related to synchronicity in that chapter, where I have a synchronicity with a client, and he's also working through aspects of his own father's death. And in that chapter, of course, I go through Jung and
we're going to have a long talk later on about Jung and so on. But what struck me was the moment that your father came to you, and shortly before his death, if I recall correctly, and said that he needed to apologize to you.
Yes.
I think that's a very powerful moment.
Yes. Yes. It was a very special, sacred moment between my father and me. And it's, it needed to happen for him and for me. It was, yes. In the book, I talk about it, and my father and I spoke about it very briefly. He was so shameful about it, and I didn't want to worsen his shame. And I knew what he was apologizing for, and we didn't need to go into great detail about it.
Would you say there was something of a telepathic connection?
Well, in the dream where my father appears later on, there's certainly telepathy there. And I can tell you, I've never had telepathy in my waking life, but in my, when I am asleep, the only person I've ever communicated with telepathically is my father. I've never had that experience in a dream image with anybody. I would say the conversation that we had was, was like Morse code. It was almost like a coded conversation. Mm-hmm. We both knew exactly what he was talking about. Oh. We just knew it.
And it seems as if when your mother talked about her conversation with your father after he died, might have had a similar quality.
I don't know. She was so tight-lipped about it. It's amazing, the contradiction. I don't believe in this, but I won't tell you about it.
Well, often these experiences are hard to put into words.
Yes. Yes. I think it was. My mother was so adamant that there was nothing out there, that the whole thing was garbage, these spiritual things. And then this happened. And, you know, I give her a lot of credit for acknowledging it, for saying, you may be onto something. I've spoken to other people who were so shut down about the paranormal. I can think of one person in particular who's described an experience of which, to me, it clearly sounded like their mother, their deceased mother, was visiting them. And it sounded like an episode of clairsentience. And I asked him about it, and I said, well, what do you think happened? And he said, well, it was just my wish. That's all it was. I just thought, you know, this is so sad. He's having a parapsychological experience, which now he's denied and distorted. And now it's sad for the spirit who's tried to reach out to her son. It's sad for both of them. At least in my mom's situation, she was open to it.
Well, as a parapsychologist, I run into this all the time, that people are having these experiences. I think roughly 70% of the population is going to have at one point or another a powerful paranormal experience.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And they're afraid to death to talk about it.
Yes. Yes. I think that fear comes from multiple places. One, when people are afraid of their own parapsychological experiences, I think a lot of it relates to the family that you grew up in and the messages that you grew up in. This stuff is weird. People are weird if they have this. People are weird if they talk about it. There's all of that. Plus, there's the cultural messages that we get, right? That this subject is weird. The other thing, too, when people get freaked out about it, is they experience a great deal of cognitive dissonance. They've had these ideas of what's what, and then this experience happens, and they're like, ooh, maybe I was wrong. And then they have to address their own cognitive dissonance, which is a bit of an ego beating for some people.
Well, at some point along the way, you made a point of educating yourself into the history and the science,
yes,
of parapsychology. Mostly it's hidden from people.
Yes. Yes. The whole subject is fascinating to me. It's an infinitely fascinating field. You know, I wrote my book 7 days a week for 1 year while I was in the process of working as a psychologist every day. And I loved it. It never felt like work. It just felt like this thing that I felt called to do that I just loved. And I loved it so much. A friend of mine refers to it as, she said, are you with your book boyfriend today? I was like, yeah, I'm with him. And, it's kind of a perfect description, mm-hmm, for it.
Well, the title of your book, Teachings from the Gatekeeper,
yes,
relates to really a very powerful experience you had with your mother very close to the time of her death.
Yes.
Let's talk about that.
Then we're giving away some of the stuff from the, you know, we the viewers won't be shocked. They won't be surprised.
Well, you want to keep it hidden. I can't force you to talk about it.
Well, my mother's last word to me, her last words, when my mother was dying, which I had sensed in my premonition, my mother stopped speaking in English. And I don't know what the language was that she spoke in. I've never heard anything like it. It didn't sound like any of the languages I've ever studied or ever heard of, nothing. But in between this foreign language, she would look to me and speak in English. And then she would sort of go back and forth. And at one point, she said to me, "You're the gatekeeper." And she said this as she's in between the state of being alive and then going into a coma. And then she would die 2 days later. And my mom didn't know this because she had no interest in spirituality. But the owl is the symbol of the gatekeeper. She would not have known that. Certainly my father wouldn't have known that. And so here I was at that point, an owl handler. And
about which we plan to do a separate interview.
We'll do it another time. Yes. Yeah.
Well, what struck me was the fact that you came to see your mother. You knew she was dying before she told you. If I remember rightly, it came in a dream.
Well, actually, it came in a premonition.
Mm-hmm.
My mother, I was on the phone with my mother one day, and her voice sounded off. Started that way. And she was very dismissive about what the problem was.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, her voice sounded more and more off to me. Then she sent me an email that just looked littered with grammatical mistakes, spelling mistakes, things that, as a psychologist, when we looked into testing protocols, looked like signs of brain damage. And I begged her to have a brain scan. She refused to do any of these things. Then she got into a car accident. It was a minor one. But the doctor found a tumor in her brain. And in the process, I would go and visit her. And after one of my trips, I came home and the premonition was just terrible. And it just kept going on and on and on and on. It lasted several days. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't eat. I could go to work. And while I was with my clients, it was the only time that I could stop thinking about my mother and my concern about her. And the premonition just kept building and building and building and building. And I went back to New York, and there are other things, but I went back to New York because the premonition was so horrible.
I recall a passage in your book where you're there at her bedside. I suppose she was in bed at the time. And she said, "Why are you here?" And you said, "Well, you called me."
Yes. I said, "You called me." And she said, "Well, I haven't called anybody. I haven't made any calls." And I said, "Mom, you didn't call me on the telephone. It was different."
Yeah.
And then she knew intuitively what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then she said, "You're a witch." Also, one of her last words to me.
Well, you know, some of those words I regard as complimentary.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, my mother was, when I went back to New York as she was dying, she started to actively die within a few hours of my arrival.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, thank God I had this premonition. I was 2,000 miles away from her. At the time, I also had an experience of clairaudience where I have never been able to identify who this spiritual being is,
mm-hmm.
but somebody, whoever he was, told me to go to New York.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in addition to the premonition and all of that.
I think you describe it as hearing a voice as clearly as my voice is speaking to you now.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It was mm-hmm. very clear.
And it's not as if you're a professional psychic, but these things come to you from time to time.
They come to me suddenly and accidentally.
Mm-hmm.
I'm somebody who's had a lot of these experiences, but they're none of them are planned. They just sort of naturally occur.
I had a similar experience after my father died.
Mm-hmm.
I flew from California to Wisconsin for the funeral.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, I consider myself a pretty secular person, but in those days, I had made a brief return to the Jewish religion, and I was attending the synagogue, and I was getting really into it, putting what are known as tefillin, uh-huh. wrapping these prayer instruments around my arm and putting them on the forehead according to a biblical injunction. My father had grown up in an Orthodox Jewish family, but he gave it up and he became a musician and went into the army and had, you know, minimal interest in religion the rest of his life. But as I'm flying home from his funeral, I'm thinking to myself on the airplane, now I will become even more active in the synagogue because I'll have minyans, which are these prayer groups that 10 men need to come together to recite prayers for the dead. And you're supposed to do that for a length of time after a funeral. So I'm thinking, this is what I'm going to do. When I heard my father's voice, clear as a bell, not obviously physical, but clear, unmistakable, and he said, son, if you want to become more active in the religion, do it for yourself. You don't need to do it for me.
Yeah.
And that was another turning point in my life, because I realized I had gone through this return to Judaism and it had completed. At that moment, I didn't need to continue to have minyans and more prayers and so on for the dead. If my father didn't need it for himself, I certainly didn't need it for myself.
Yes. Yes. He gave you the freedom to do it your way.
Yeah.
However it was that you needed to do it.
But it was, I regard that to this day as an authentic communication.
Yes.
It wouldn't have occurred. It wasn't on my mind to think that way, but it led to a real shift in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about turning points.
Yeah, and that clairaudience too.
And a defining experience.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So over time, you made a point of studying the data of parapsychology.
Yes.
Most psychologists don't bother. In fact, yes. I have found that of all the different professions that relate in one way or another to parapsychology, psychologists themselves are often the most hostile and critical.
Yes.
And I think it's because they feel the most threatened by it.
Yes. I think that they do feel threatened. It's seen as a contaminant.
Yeah.
Whereas to me, it's baffling to me why undergrads do not have introduction to parapsychology. This whole thing started, my book started because I missed teaching terribly. I really, really missed it. And I thought about pitching a course of introduction to psychology to the local university.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked into the recent textbooks that have been published on the subject, and there was not one of them that really interested me. I wanted something that was just packed with research that was also really fun. And I couldn't find anything. And so I thought, you know what, why don't you just write your own book? Then you can have the most academic freedom. You can say whatever you want. And I use my experiences as teaching examples. I look through the research and the theories of Nobel laureates, professors emeriti, professors from all over the United States. And I look at how have all of these people examined the subject. And then I weave in my personal examples as teaching examples, as case studies, so that the reader has these tangible things for them to focus on.
And the importance is that you're not a special person in the world of a psychic functioning. You have some gifts. I think you said, well, on a scale of 1 to 100, I'm probably a 70. And I'm probably about the same myself, yeah. which means that your life and my life and the lives of undoubtedly hundreds of other people, if not thousands or millions, are punctuated with psychic events, psychic phenomena, psychic experiences, usually when we need them.
Yes. And it's something that gives us an ability to translate it. Right. I look at my book as a translation of what the academic material is, how it looks like in a real person.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing to study something. It's another thing to experience it personally. I know exactly, let's say, what clairaudience looks like. I know it because I've experienced it. And in the book, I explain the difference between what's a clairaudient regular person and what's a person who has schizophrenia. And how are those things different, right? Both of those people are hearing voices. How exactly is a clairaudient psychic different from a schizophrenic who hears voices? And there's all sorts of different clinical reasons as to why those two people are not the same psychologically. But my having had experience with clairaudience is the kind of thing that helps me to be able to make that translation, just like you can make the translation of all sorts of other psi episodes that you've had and compare it with the research that you've studied.
Now, earlier you talked about this premonition prior to your mother's death and how it sort of worked on you for months, I gather.
Well, that particular premonition worked on me. I'm going to take it back. So I heard her voice. It was like a rumbling that happened, right? Where I had this bad feeling about it. And then that vague bad feeling got worse. And then it steadily got worse and it steadily got more specific. So then there's this period of the premonition building. And then there's the period when I came back from one of my visits where I had 5 days where I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. I started to break out into a fever. The only thing I could do was to see my clients. It was horrific. And I called people who were with my mom. They said, no, she's fine. Don't worry about it. And I was like, no, I'm packing a bag and I'm going, I have to see how she's doing.
Sometimes these things build over time.
Yes.
I had a experience, I think I would call it the phrase you use, claircognizance.
Yes.
After I made the decision to leave criminology and to pursue a career having to do with what I would call the positive side of human deviance. And I didn't know quite what that would be, but it had something to do with mysticism, something to do with the paranormal, something to do with intuition and creativity.
Yeah.
But I had no way of finding a path at the university where I was to pursue such a career. They just didn't offer courses in any of those areas. And I agonized for months and months and months. Well, actually, to be precise, about 3 or 4 months. And then one day, I had, I think I would call it your phrase, claircognizance. I woke up in the morning and I knew without any doubt that yes. that night I was going to have a dream. And in the dream, I would find the answer. I've told this story many times because it led ultimately to the work I'm doing with you right now, interviewing.
Sure.
And I did have such a dream, but I knew in advance, yeah. tonight's the night the dream will come.
That's claircognizance.
Yeah.
Where nobody could have shaken that out of you. Nobody could have convinced you this is not going to happen.
No, there was absolutely no doubt.
Yes. Yes. I would describe claircognizance as I'm aware that I have white skin. I'm 5'7". I've got brown eyes. Nobody can convince me otherwise.
Mm. Of course, that's a common experience. You have that every day of your life. But the one that you had concerning your mother and some of the others, the one that I had concerning that dream, it's like a once in a lifetime.
Yes. No, but I mean in terms of the level of certainty
mm-hmm.
that nobody could have convinced
yeah.
you, right?
Yeah. That's true. But of course, nobody tried, and I didn't even share it with people. I just knew.
Yes.
I wasn't exactly. going to try and spoil it by telling anybody.
Yeah. Well, and also it was too special maybe to want to share that with somebody. You know, that was something that was so specific to your relationship with yourself that maybe you didn't want to talk about it because it's like, well, that's, I want to keep that.
It's kind of sacred.
It's sacred. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now you, if I recall correctly in your book, though, you do make a distinction between a premonition.
Yes.
And a precognition.
Yes.
Can you describe that?
A premonition is usually a vague feeling.
Mm.
It's a vague sense of foreboding and it's typically negative. And it's vague and it keeps building and it keeps getting worse.
Mm.
In my book, I also talk about Abraham Lincoln, who had a premonition about that. And when it comes to precognition, I also talk about Abraham Lincoln's precognitive dream that he had about 10 days before his assassination. And a precognition is specific. The premonition is vague. And the precognition usually involves specific pieces of information.
Lincoln had a very specific dream about his body being carried
yes.
on what is known as a catafalque, the carriage that where the corpse is. And
yes.
he asks what's going on. And people say, well, the president has died.
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So in that chapter, I talk about precognitive dreams and I look at his particular dream, and I bring in an example of a cognitive dream of mine, as well as precognitive dreams of Carl Jung and precognitive dreams of other mm-hmm. people as well.
I do recall, now that you mention it, one day, again, early in my life, I had climbed a mountain. I climbed Mount Shasta, over 14,000
wow.
feet. It was an exhilarating, wonderful experience. But as I was climbing down the mountain and going back from this beautiful wilderness to the San Francisco Bay Area to resume my work at school, and I had many exciting prospects waiting for me at the time, I had a foreboding.
Mm-hmm.
I had a dark feeling something was going to happen, and it did. I had a very negative experience. People actually threatened my life.
Oh, my God.
And literally came into my bedroom at night with knives and threw hot boiling water on me and said they were about to kill me.
Oh, my God, how scary.
It was. Well, it wasn't, actually. That's the funny thing. I rarely told this story to people, but I became possessed. It changed my life dramatically, I can tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
But at the moment of the greatest danger, I was possessed by a unnatural calmness. I felt almost like Jesus Christ. I was stark naked, and there are these people with knives and boiling water threatening to kill me, and I just stood up without any fear whatsoever. When they saw me in this state, they became frightened and ran away. And it was a gift. It didn't, it was as if something outside of me, some other spiritual being, possessed me at that moment.
And protected you.
And protected me, yeah.
Yeah. Well, what you're also hitting on is the same things that the early researchers like Louisa Ryan and J.B. Ryan and Carl Jung talked about, where it seems to be the most salient pieces of information come during periods involving death or potential death, major life circumstances, births, marriages, things of that nature.
Defining moments.
Yeah. You know, these kinds of major experiences that somehow, when it comes to ESP, we seem to be picking out these kinds of episodes. We're not picking out the mundane, right? It's not, we're your premonition, right? This sense of foreboding that you had happened was because some part of you was sensing that your life was potentially at risk, and it was starting to prepare you for that.
Yeah.
You were experiencing the preparedness, and this is what the early researchers were talking about, right? That it's these most important pieces that our psyches pick out the most.
Well, the irony is that these are some of the most crucial experiences in anybody's life.
Yes.
And yet the profession of psychology studiously ignores them.
It's mind-blowing. It's mind-blowing. It is absolutely... It's I've never understood it. When we look at parapsychological experiences, they're about people connecting with each other. They're about people connecting with themselves. They are about people connecting with the spirit world. I mean, this is all about attachment and things that psychology, of course, is all over. How is it that psychology, in its mainstream sense, is not dialed in and at least open to this, right?
That is an excellent question. And all I can say is I think it's changing slowly, but there are lots of signs. For example, somebody recently wrote to me about an academic paper, and it was published on the topic of spiritual awakenings, mm-hmm. and comparing spiritual awakenings with what they call kundalini experiences, a very exotic kind of yoga phenomenon. And this paper in an academic journal had been read 300,000 times.
Mm-hmm.
It suggests to me that even within the profession of psychology, maybe it's younger people coming up or older people who no longer feel the pressures of needing to get tenure. I think things are opening. I expect 10 years, 50 years from now, we'll be in a very different environment.
I certainly hope that will happen. I mean, it's really, I've never understood how the field of psychology, especially clinical psychology, could be so dismissive of this. A couple of months ago, I suddenly had this hit. And actually, it happened in a couple of different instances, but I had this sort of this hit psychically that this person who I have not been in contact with in any capacity whatsoever for 10 and a half years, I suddenly had this awareness that I was going to hear from them. It's an amazing thing. Mm-hmm. And then I did.
Uh-huh.
They were 5,000 miles away from me.
Yeah.
And I still picked this up.
Yeah.
It's an amazing experience. Why the field of psychology would not focus on something like that is strange to me.
And you know, almost automatically, if you talk to a professional psychologist, you'll get the knee-jerk reaction to the effect, well, how many times did you have a premonition like that and it didn't happen?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, they want to see laboratory evidence, and yet there we have 100 years of laboratory evidence that they act as if it doesn't exist either.
Well, the other thing too, what I've seen is that when people are so shut down to this, mm-hmm. I can think of one person, for example. We were talking about Stevenson and Ian Stevenson. For some people who may not have known about him, he's the world's most renowned researcher of reincarnation.
The late Ian Stevenson.
Yes, yes. And he researched about 3,000 cases of children with cases of reincarnation all over the globe.
Yeah, we've covered it extensively on this channel.
So, and I write about him in my book. Mm-hmm. And this person, I was talking to them about Dr. Ian Stevenson and what he did. And the response that I got was, well, maybe if I saw the medical photographs. And I said, well, you can see them. I've given the citation. Here's the reference for the medical. Mm. Nah, I don't want to see the photographs.
Well, that's the world we're living in today. But Davis, yeah. Bremberg, you're doing something to help change that world.
Thank you.
Writing your book and being so open as a psychologist about these experiences and tying them to the academic literature in parapsychology. I salute you.
Thank you. Well, thank you so much for reading my book and for having me here today.
Thank you for coming. And for those of you watching or listening, thank you for being with us, because you are the reason that we are here. Book 2 in the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues book series is a tribute to parapsychologist Russell Targ, celebrating his 90th birthday. New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.